Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good. Thanks again to Mark Moj Johnson for our musical theme. And welcome to Solder Smoke 96. It's Monday, the 8th of December, 2008. I'm a day late with Solder Smoke. Sorry for that. I just slept in, and it's a good day for us to do a new edition of Solder Smoke. It's a holiday in Italy. It's the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And this being a very, well, I guess the maximum Catholic country, we got the day off. And it gives me a chance to catch up on Solder Smoke here. First, I guess a little bit of an Italian travelogue while we're on the subject. Weather is still very nice in Italy. Of course, snow is very rare here in Rome. I think it last snowed here about 15 years ago. But we did have some hail the other day, and it covered parts of the city in a snow-like substance for a little while, but it wasn't real snowfall. And actually, it was almost like summertime because it was associated with a big thunderstorm. Unfortunately, we don't have any lightning or thunder to accompany the show. We did, I guess, about a year ago. But lightning and thunder in November and December has been pretty common the last couple of years. I understand that's not the norm here in Rome. But we had a beautiful day yesterday. Took the kids up to the park up on top of the hill, up on the Janiculum. Not one of Rome's famed seven hills, but the hill that was just right outside the wall and on the other side of the river, dedicated to the god Janus, I believe, hence the Janiculum. And it's a real nice park, and so we took the kids up there for a walk, met up with some friends, let them kick the soccer ball around for a while. You could see snow-capped mountains. It was a clear day yesterday, so as we walked back down the hill, you looked off in the distance and you could see snow-capped mountains off on the horizon. That was real nice. You could also see, this is the time of year when you get flocks of birds. I think they're starlings. They're little birds. And great swarms of them come over Rome, and they fly around and they're beautiful. The patterns are beautiful if you're far away from them. If you're close to them and you're underneath of them, it's probably not all that beautiful. Actually, they're a big problem for Rome. They come in this time of year. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about them last week, and they talked about how these birds normally never came into central Rome. They stayed out in the countryside, but for whatever reason, for the last, the last 10 years or so, this time of year, they come into Rome in the millions. I think there's 3 or 4 million of them. And like I said, when you're up close, they're a problem. The Romans know about this problem, and it'll be a clear day. You'll be walking home. There's not a cloud in the sky, and all of a sudden you'll start to see around you umbrellas popping open. And these are mostly, I think, women who are more conscious of this kind of thing, but they're worried about getting bombarded for good reason, because when the cloud of these birds comes overhead, well, it can get messy. Of course, the tourists who are not briefed are standing there looking up, often, you know, open-mouthed in amazement. And I often think this is not the best posture to observe this particular natural phenomenon. So anyway, the starlings are here, the mountains are snow-capped, the weather is good, life is good in Rome. Hey, I came across a couple of things that I think you guys will be interested in, and I'm going to try to post these on the blog. One, you know, Google is doing Street View. They're sending cars around all over the world, and with panoramic 360-degree cameras whirling around up on the roof. And they have recently passed through our neighborhood. So there's a pretty good Google Street View of the Piazza di San Cosimato. That's C-O-S-I-M-A-T-O. I'll try to post it up on the website, but on the actually on the blog page, soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you guys could take a look at the neighborhood. Also, somebody sent me, and it's posted up on the Blogspot page in one of the comments sections, a panoramic shot that somebody took of the Porto Portese street market that that we've been talking about in recent episodes. That's already up on the page. You just have to dig down into the comments section. I think it's in the comments section when we describe the flea market. But I'll try to post that more prominently also, and it'll get you give listeners a chance to take a look at what the local neighborhood here is in beautiful downtown Trastevere, Rome. It really is a nice place. Hey, okay. First thing on the list, I guess I'm just looking at things that I have up on the Blogspot page, and I want to say I've been making some disparaging comments about Make magazine and the Maker blog. I accuse them of drifting away from soldering irons and toward knitting needles. I noted that there seemed to be a disproportionate amount of macrame on their website recently. But I have to say that Make has recently redeemed itself, and they posted onto their blog a really interesting video about the light-emitting diode, the history of the light-emitting diode, uses the light-emitting diode. My son Billy is really interested in LEDs and lasers, as you guys have heard. So this was of particular interest to him. And I have embedded the video about LEDs onto the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. So check it out. I think you'll like the video, and thanks to the guys there at Make and Maker. I take back all the bad things I said about you. You've redeemed yourself completely with that video, and I hope they produce more of it. Let me tell you about my latest project here. This is one of the things that's been slowing down recent Solder Smoke episodes, but I'm sure you'll all agree that it's a worthy cause. I've taken the amplifier chain that I've been describing, and I've put it to work inside the 80-meter double sideband transmitter that I started building several years ago back in London. This is what I refer to as my kick panel rig, because the box that it's in is made mostly of a piece of aluminum kick panel that I bought in a hardware store on Fulham Road in London. It's a real simple circuit, just audio amplifier with a 741 op amp that goes to a balanced modulator, singly balanced modulator using two diodes and the standard three-winding toroidal coil, tri-filler toroidal coil. Say that three times fast. It's got a simple VFO operating at the operating frequency. And so you have the VFO going in to one port, the audio going into another port, and double sideband coming out at the output where you'd expect it, of course. And then it goes off to this amplifier that I've built that produces about 45 dBs of gain, and that gets the whole thing up to about 3.5 watts of double sideband. I've been talking about this, and I posted the LT Spice model on the blog page, and was really delighted. I got feedback from ZOI himself, from Wes. He was kind enough to take the time to send some recommendations. And the one thing that he advised me to do was to go ahead and put some decoupling networks on the first three stages of the amplifier. And I'd mentioned that I had put an RF choke and some capacitors to ground between the 12 12-volt line and the final amplifier stage. But Wes said that I should definitely go ahead and decouple the other stages. So I put, I think there are 10-ohm resistors between the 12-volt line and the amplifier stages with 0.1 microfarad caps to ground, and that will prevent things from getting out of hand. He also recommended that I put a small resistor in parallel with the RF choke on the final amplifier stage, basically to DQ it. And so I followed all that good advice, and indeed it helped. And I put the amplifier into the rig, and you know, I must say this is the easiest RF power amplifier chain that I've ever built in terms of getting it to work properly. You've all, longtime listeners, have heard about the trials and tribulations that I've faced when trying to get amplifiers to amplifier not to oscillate, to get things stable. It's a long, long, sad story. I think this project demonstrates the benefits of design, discipline, and planning. I guess it shows that it really is better to go, you know, ready, aim, fire, and do some planning instead of the old kind of cut and try hack. Let's see if this thing works with that thing. Let's take this bit of circuit and just sort of scotch tape the schematics together and then build it. And let's not pay any attention to those things like impedance levels and impedance matching and decoupling and all that stuff. Well, you know, I've been there, guys. I've tried that. I've lived that way. And I'm telling you, there's a better way to do it. This is the better way to do it. This is the, I guess what you could call the experimental methods portion of EMRFD. This shows the benefits of actually measuring things like, you know, input and output levels and matching impedances and actually designing things before you build them. Now, there's a concept. This is a new one for me. Design, build. In that sequence, design, build. I'm telling you, it works out better that way. It certainly has in this case, because this chain of amplifiers has been stable all along. I haven't had any unwanted oscillations or feedback or spurs or parasitics or anything like that. It's really been great. I think the other thing that's really helped here has been the use of feedback. All four stages have feedback in them, and this, I think, has been a real help. I have got a couple of questions, though, about feedback. If you look at how different designers draw the feedback circuits, some of them draw the feedback circuits differently, and I'm going to try to post the different ways of drawing them up on the web. I have a tendency to have two resistors in series, and then one of the resistors has a bypass cap in parallel to it. And that bypass cap basically takes that resistor out of the picture for RF and leaves the second resistor to determine the amount of feedback. The two resistors, of course, combine to produce the bias voltage on the base of the transistor. Other designers draw it very differently, and I really can't figure out why. I'll have to try to do the two versions there. But those of you who are really interested in really into this level of design will know what I'm talking about. I'm just wondering why different designers draw the shunt feedback or the collector to base feedback circuits differently. Another question about feedback, and I send this out to those who are the more advanced designers here. When you read in the literature about the benefits of feedback, several different benefits are mentioned. One is that it gives the designer the ability to control the input and output impedances of the stages. And this is really helpful when you're trying to get develop systems where each stage has 50 ohms input. That's even when you're a beginner at this, as I am, it becomes very apparent that that's a really useful thing to have. And I, like I said in the last episode, I used the program FBA, feedback amps that comes with the EMRFD, to play with the values of the different of the two of the degenerative and collector to base feedback circuits to make sure that each stage was more or less at 50 ohms. That was really helpful. That's really good. The other thing is that the feedback lets you determine and control stage gain. So you can say, all right, with these different amounts of feedback, you can control the amount of gain of each stage. But there's a third part of it that I'm not quite sure I get. And it's often said that by using feedback, you get to kind of take out of the design picture variations between individual devices, between individual transistors. And in the same batch of transistors, say 2N2222s, you have different gains. I guess it's the different betas in there from device to device. And by using feedback, you can control for this and make sure that each stage, each version of the amplifier that's built, even when you're using different devices, even from the same batch, that the feedback will help you compensate for these differences in gain between individual devices, and make sure that the stage has the same amount of gain roughly that each time the design is reproduced. I don't really get that. I'm having a tough time seeing that, because if you have one transistor that inherently has more gain in it than another, it doesn't seem to me that having feedback in there would take care of this problem. It seems that you'd still have more gain coming out of the device that was produced with the higher gain device there. I don't know if I'm describing myself clearly here, but I played around with it a little bit in the simulator in SPICE and in FBA. And when I do change the value for the DC gain of the transistor or change the HFE on it to sort of throw in there possible variations in device characteristics, the stage gain does show quite a bit of variation. So I'm just wondering if I'm misunderstanding that a little bit. I guess I am. That's a real good possibility. But that's two questions there that I throw out for the real designers out there who may be listening. I've been having a lot of fun with LT Spice. I got a reminder message from Wes saying not to put too much faith in LT Spice and to remember that the important thing is to actually build these stages and then test on the real world stage. And Wes reminded me that the greater experiment is in the simulation, and then you can't really overestimate the amount, the degree to which the simulation actually simulates the real world. So thanks for that reminder, Wes, and I've taken it to heart. And there have been a couple occasions where I saw something weird in the simulation, and I said, well, that might just be a ghost in the machine there. And sure enough, when I went over to the workbench, it was a bit different when I looked at it in the real world. Although I must say it's very gratifying and interesting when you look at the waveform on the real oscilloscope on the workbench, and it looks remarkably similar to the one produced by the virtual oscilloscope there in LT Spice. So those of you who don't have LT Spice on your computers, I recommend that you go ahead and download it. It's free, and it's really useful and a lot of fun. But as Wes said, don't get carried away. So I've been The other benefit of LT Spice is that I'm not really all that disciplined about writing down circuit changes and keeping track of them. And I find myself, I walk away from a circuit and I come back a week or two later and I wonder, what the heck was I doing with that? What was the latest change that I made? I know you're supposed to have a notebook there. I know you're supposed to be very disciplined and write everything down. But let's face it, guys, we're talking about the real world and real radio amateurs. And we don't always do what's recommended. I remember when I was a kid, the ARRL books would describe the process by which you should plan the placement of components on a new chassis, a new aluminum or steel chassis for a tube type rig, and they would show somebody very carefully covering the chassis with brown paper, you know, the kind of paper from that you'd get from a supermarket, the kind of from a supermarket bag, the kind of paper that they always use to make covers for your textbooks in school. Well, you're supposed to take that paper and wrap it around the chassis, and then very carefully, with almost with the skill of a draftsman, plot out the placement of every component, every tube socket, every coil form, every variable capacitor, and all the little holes that would be used to mount these components. Yeah. You know, that's what... maybe that's the way they did it up there in Newington, Connecticut. But in the real world, many of us just started drilling holes and hoped that we didn't run out of chassis before we ran out of components. And so, as I say, that's, you know, there's a difference between recommended practice and real-world practice. But what I'm getting at here, guys, is LT Spice provides, at least for me, a way to more faithfully keep track of circuit changes. Because what I usually do is, if I'm thinking about changing the value of a component, of a resistor or something in there, I'll change it in LT Spice, see what it looks like in the simulator. And then if the simulator says, yeah, that's pretty much what I'm hoping for, then I'll go over and change it on the workbench. Once I change it on the workbench, or if I like the way it works, I just hit the save button on LT Spice, and well, now it's in there, and now I have a record of what I've done, and there it is. The schematic is updated, so it's for me. That's another advantage of using this thing. Some of the circuit changes that you can make and that you can check out in LT Spice, it's really been interesting because it's a way to apply the theory first to the simulator, then to the real world. It's been a real good experience for me. For example, when I got this whole amplifier chained together, the amount of gain that I wanted, the amount of power out that I was getting, was not quite what I was hoping for. And in the real world there, I was getting, I needed another 2 or 3 dB of gain to get up to the power level that I wanted. And I looked at the circuit and I realized that if I got a bit more gain from the final amplifier stage, I could probably get away with it. I wasn't pushing the device to up close to any limits. And I could probably increase the gain by a sufficient amount simply by reducing the amount of collector to base feedback. And of course, this would have an impact on input impedance and things like that. So I checked it out in FBA and in LT Spice. And when it looked like the reduction in the amount of feedback from collector to base would produce the desired amount of increasing gain, and I'd be able to kind of play with the values to keep the input impedance at around 50 ohms. Then I went over and made the change in the real world circuit, and lo and behold, it worked, and I was at the desired power output level. Now that brings us to real world operation of this rig, and I am on the air on 80 meters with a prodigious 3.5 watts of double sideband output to a less than ideal urban antenna, but I'm making CUSOs. they're not easy. The Italians had a contest this weekend on 80 meters, and a friend of mine here in the area recommended that this might be a good time for me to go out and try out the rig. Let me tell you, the contesters, I don't think, at least here, are not used to listening for a 3.5 watt double sideband signals. I made a few CUSOs, but it was kind of rough. I think these guys, the contesters, are just not used to rigs that sound in any way different from the Yaesu Icom Kenwood variety of 100 watt rigs. And so when they say over or avanti, they're listening for kind of a 100-watt rig to a fairly high dipole, single sideband, not double sideband kind of signal. And also, because they're only used to working with other transceivers, they're not used to a signal that is being zero-beated by ear. I'm using the rig with the Drake 2B, and of course I have to zero-beat, and I do it by ear. And of course, the zero might not be completely, the beat might not be completely zero. Anyway, so I get a lot of curious expressions like, "What's that I'm hearing?" and "Who's that?" And I think I hear somebody, but wow, they're weak and maybe a bit off frequency. So I decided not to torture these poor contesters anymore. I made a few contacts, and that was that. But now I have a rig, and I can talk to locals on 80 meters. I'm not sure how useful a 3.5 watt rig will be, but it's certainly been a good design and construction project. Let me tell you the only real debugging problem that I had with it, and it's an interesting one. One of the things I wanted to do with this rig was use a completely homebrew balanced modulator, not the ubiquitous NE602. As much as we love the NE602, they are not, you know, the completely homebrew circuit. The two diodes. Two diodes, the toroid and the balancing resistor circuit that we see in so many circuits, especially so many circuits by Doug DeMaugh. I like using that circuit because of its simplicity. But I discovered something with it. One, well, that it's kind of hard to find 100 ohm variable resistors. So I had to kind of make one up on my own. I found in the junk box a 25 ohm variable resistor, and I just tacked two 33 ohm resistors, one on each leg, and sort of made up a a close to 100 ohm balancing resistor there. That seems to work out pretty well. But I've read in a number of articles, including one about the BitX20 written by our friend Farhan, about the need for proper termination of this kind of singly balanced two-diode mixer circuit or balanced modulator circuit. And you really need to make sure that all the output frequencies are basically looking into a 50-ohm hopefully resistive load. If not, some of the energy that at the output goes back in and starts mixing again. And well, let me tell you, it gets ugly, guys, and you move very quickly away from the nice kind of two-toned pattern that you see in the vaunted, hallowed pages of the ARRL handbook. Anyway, that's what happened to me, and so I started kind of experimenting and thinking about putting in kind of complicated diplexer circuits, which is what is often recommended at this point. In the BitX20, Farhan and the other designers, I think, went with just a simple a resistive attenuator pad. I think they went, I'm not sure whether it was a 3 dB pad or a 6 dB pad, but they put just a resistive pad in there as a simple solution to properly terminate the balanced modulator before moving on to the amplifier chain. I was in the process of doing that. I put in a filter, a low-pass filter, just a three-element low-pass filter. That helped a bit. But then I still found that the desired beautiful kind of two-tone pattern that was coming out of the amplifier at the end and even at the output of the double of the balanced modulator, it wasn't there. And so just by experimentation, I did is I put a 50 ohm resistor across the output of the low pass filter, and then I put that to the input of the amplifier chain, and it really cleaned things up. Now I realize I'm losing power in heating up that resistor, but it really cleaned up the audio and the signal, and everything was really beautiful and the way it's supposed to be all the way through. So I may eventually go in there and do it properly and put a diplexer in there. But for now, just the 50 ohm load at the output of the modulator works very well. I tried to experiment a little bit, and even if I increase the amount of resistance up to 200 ohms, that didn't do it. It helped, but it didn't clean up the signal. So I became aware that there really is a need for a 50 ohm termination of that that balanced modulator circuit. And as again, mine is not really I think optimum, but so far it's working. Let's see. What do we have here? All right, that's the description of the latest project. Wes predicted this would happen. I guess it was my contest experience, but I started thinking about more power. These guys can't hear me, so I dragged out one of these old Ramsey kit amplifiers with the two MOSFET transistors in push pull, and I briefly fooled around with that, but now I'm deviating from the experimental method procedure, and I'm going back to the bad old days. So I've put that aside, and I promise not to start hacking away again in search of higher output levels. It's remember design build. All right, so I'm going to try to stick to that. So enough of the Ramsey amp. It wouldn't have been completely homebrew anyway. You guys know what I mean. All right, let's see. Oh, a reading recommendation. We've been giving kind of not book reviews but magazine reviews, and this week a gift from Mom came through. Air and Space from the Smithsonian, the January 2009 edition. Really good. I love this magazine. It's really, really one of the best. And it's not really about the knack, but it's about people who have interests that are related and close to the knack. There's a really interesting article in here about Red Whitaker's rovers and robots. These guys are going after the Google Prize. I think I've mentioned this here before, but it's just so good. I got to mention it again. For a team to claim the Google Prize, its robot has to land on the lunar surface, travel at least 500 meters, and send high-definition images and data back to Earth within 24 hours. The first team to do so will win $20 million. Bonus awards totaling $5 million are offered for extras, such as photographing an artifact of previous lunar exploration, traveling more than 5,000 meters, and operating for a second 2-week lunar day. To win the full award, the mission must be completed by the end of 2012, and 90% of the funding has to come from private sources. So far, 14 teams have announced their intention to compete for the prize. Man, that's a good one. And the article is in there about the robots that these guys build and how they approach it. I don't know, guys. I think this one's beyond us. I know we had a solder smoke team involved in the SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But I don't know if we are this one. I don't know, man. Landed on the lunar surface. That's a tough one. Anyway, I thought that was a good article. There's another one in here. Another article as I flipped through the pages. Ah, this is the one. Welcome to Cyber Airspace. This is a really good article about a world that I'd only been dimly aware of, about the world of virtual airlines. These guys, you know, it's a sort of an internet extension of the flight simulator program, which, by the way, I have to get one for Billy. I want him to stop shooting aliens and maybe do something useful with the games. And I guess flying 747s into Heathrow would be a better use of time. But here's an article about the world of virtual airlines. You know, guys, it's useful for us to keep track of people who have hobbies that are even weirder than ours. It's hard to do. We have to face facts and realize that we are definitely out there in the hobby and extracurricular interest department. These guys are possibly, it's arguable, but they're possibly even weirder than us. And you really should take a look at this article. It's interesting. I don't mean to mock them, because we are, I think, very much in the same league of geeky nerdiness. But these guys have constructed an entire universe of virtual airlines and virtual air traffic controllers. And they all hold positions in the different airlines, and they have to qualify with the different aircraft. And it's interesting. Reminiscent of the Knack. So those are the two things, two of the many things I found interesting in the January 2009 issue of Air and Space. And thanks to the folks at Smithsonian who bring us that really nice magazine. Astronomy stuff. Haven't been doing too much astronomy. I haven't had the telescope up on the roof lately. But those of you who were out and about in the afternoon and evening hours know that there's been a real nice alignment of the Moon and Venus and Jupiter in the evening sky. For a day or so there, they were really very closely aligned. And I think the Moon covered up Venus there at one point. But we were up, as we were walking home yesterday, I looked up and pointed out Jupiter and Venus to the wife and kids. They were, of course, duly amazed. And I hear Saturn is up in the morning. I have to be careful about early morning astronomy here, guys, because lurking about up on the roof at 8:30 at night is kind of socially acceptable. My Italian radio amateur friends find early morning hours, even for radio amateurs, a bit weird. When I tell them that I'm up at 5 o'clock in the morning in the shack, often this news is greeted with stunned silence. So I'm conscious of the fact you have to think about the cultural environment in which you're operating. And if my diehard radio amateur friends, Italian radio amateur friends, are kind of shocked by working in the shack at 5 a.m., I have to think that the neighbors here would think that me crawling around on the roof with a telescope at at 5 a.m. would be maybe a little bit beyond the pale. So the early morning astronomy, well, and discretion is the better part of valor here, as they say. And so I haven't been up on the roof with the telescope at that hour, but apparently other people have been out there looking at celestial objects. And Randy, N3UMW, has sent a very nice picture that of Saturn that he took with an 8-inch reflector telescope and a webcam. He rigged up, and this is where we get the connection to electronics and homebrew and gadgets. I've seen this this trick before, but the way Randy described it was really really nice, and so I posted it up on the blog. You can see Randy's picture of Saturn. What he's done is he's taken an old webcam, one of these old little eyeball kind of, you know, webcams that are all over the place, and I think we all have two or three of these floating around in the junk box someplace. He took the lens off it, basically mounted it so the output of the telescope was going right into the charge couple device detector in the webcam, and then it goes right to the laptop, and I think they shoot a movie, so they're getting many, many different images, and then there's software that you could use to put them all together, and the result is a very, very nice picture of Saturn there, and I've got it posted up on the blog. Something else I posted up there is information on the beacon transmitter that that Ben Gelb, my old friend from the Vienna Wireless Society, and his friends at MIT have been using for balloon projects. I think you guys will find this circuit very interesting. It produces about a watt and a half of CW, and the whole thing is built for economy because most of them are going to go down somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. So they put the whole transmitter together for about $25. So it's no real great loss if a thing goes down at sea and you never see it again. But there's a picture of the rig there and a link to Ben's page. If you go to Ben's page, look carefully because they have one link to some maps that show the paths of the balloons that they launched. And I thought that was really interesting. So thanks for Ben for sending that along. Let me just take a look here, see what else I have. I'm shifting over to Billy's computer. Let's see. Oh, man, they want me to log on. See what else we have on the... Because I often put stuff up on the blog, and then I forget about it and don't mention it on Solder Smoke. Okay, there's Saturn. There's Ben N1VF's MIT Balloon Beacon Transmitter. We have that up there. Ah, listen, I got to plug Billy's blog. Billy, I guess, maybe influenced by me, but also by some of the stuff that they've been working on at school, figured out how to set up his own blog. So he's got it. He's got a blog, and if you go to the Solder Smoke page, scroll down a bit, you'll see a link to his blog. Please visit it. He loves to get the red dots popping up on his cluster map screen, and if you have anything to comment, he really likes to get comments. So go to Billy's page, Billy's blog page, and you can find the link to it at the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. I promised him that I'd plug his blog here on Solder Smoke. He loves to get visits and comments, so please check it out. That's an important project for us. Let's see, scrolling down, I've got the video on the LEDs. You guys will like that. And then we're back to the update on my kick panel amplifier from last week. So that brings us up to date on the blog. Got a little bit of QRSS MEPT news. This is, I think, interesting. I've had the beacon on, not continuously, because I've had to take it off for actual two-way QSOs on 80 meters with the new rig. But most of the time, the beacon has been on, and there's been a lot of beacon activity, and a lot of U.S. and European signals have been picked up in VK6 land. That's been real interesting. But something came across the Knights mailing list. Do you know the Knights are the mailing list of the QRSS. MEPT guys, to be legal here, we have to refer to them as Manned Experimental Propagation Transmitters, MEPTs. One of the stalwarts of the MEPT world, and a guy who has a travel schedule that's far more exotic than mine, we're talking about Lawrence, KL1X, also known as 9 Victor 1 Lima Foxtrot, recently of Singapore. This guy moves and lives in exotic locations. He has a really interesting life. And like I said, recently based in Singapore, and he operated an online grabber there in Singapore that was very useful and allowed us to see if any of our signals were reaching that part of the world. Then he moved back to Alaska. And he didn't stay in Alaska too long because yesterday he posted to the mailing list the fact that he has changed locations and is now operating from northern China. Man, there's an exotic location. And he is going to set up an online grabber for QRSS out of northern China. So this opens up new possibilities for those of us in the QRSS MEPT world, and thanks very much for that, Lawrence. We look forward to seeing your online grabber appear on the internet. Great stuff. All right, now it's time. Let's see. Wait a second. Hold on. Stand by one. All right. Two versions of this. Steve Snort Rosin has asked for the real world blog. So those of you who are sensitive to loud noises, please remove the earphones at this point. Try to maintain control of your vehicles. Here you go. I don't think that was too bad. Okay. And now the digital version.
It's time for...
Awesome.
Indeed.
Yeah, solder smoke mailbag. We got the continuing subject of solder scents, like S-C-E-N-T-S. this was again launched by Snort Rosin there. I guess with a nickname like that, you would expect an interest in solder smells. Not to belabor the point, but Roger, K7RXV, writes in about solder smells, and he points out that at one point, Heathkit apparently was sensitive to this issue and included in a kit for color TV sets a solder that was actually scented to make it smell like Pine Sol. Man, if you're gonna go to the trouble of putting odors into the deliberately putting odor into the solder, why select Pine Sol? Can't you do better than the Pine Sol? I mean, can't you go with Chanel No. 5 or something like that? I guess it just shows you that engineers were in charge of this project. And they said, hey, Fred, what should we make the solder smell like? And the other guy said, I don't know. I kind of like Pine Sol. So anyway, Roger, thanks for sending that along. And Bob, KD4EBM, continues on this theme. And he comes up with the commentary, if we were to use sort of wine critic language when discussing solder smells, he notes, multi-core 6040, an impetuous little solder with an almost belligerent odor. They call it the rascal of the parts rack. All right, enough of that. Okay. We will not. We'll be willing to take a few more comments on solder smoke and solder smell. But let's get back to solder smoke. Anyway, speaking of which, Jerry NR5A has become a real enthusiastic convert of Whisper. This is the version. Kind of a QRSS, but an automated QRSS, WSPR. Google it if you guys are interested in it. It's for now, it's beyond my technical capabilities because I don't really have any kind of any SSB rigs that are stable enough to run this. But Jerry has been working the world on 80 meter Whisper with just 2 milliwatts. Really impressive, and I could tell from the. From the tone of his message, that it was that he's been having a lot of fun with that. So glad to hear that you're completely back in the action there, Jerry, and trying new things. That's exactly the kind of stuff that keeps you going. So I'm glad you're enjoying Whisper and working the world on 2 milliwatts. There you go, QRP, QRPPP. Scott at KD5NJR sent a nice message and commented on the book Soul of a New Machine. And he said that when he was in school, that book helped him gain the motivation to stick with the electrical engineering program. So, and he was pleased to have memories brought back of that book by Tracy Kidder. So, thanks for the note there, Bob. Now we got a message here from. From Bob, K7HBG, and this is kind of on a. I know this will provoke some a little bit of controversy, and he is experimenting with software defined radios, and so he's into the new technology, guys. He's not a Luddite here. He's not talking bad about it. But he does comment and say that at a certain level, and I think many of us share this sentiment, that he still feels that, quote, real radios have knobs. I guess real radios have real knobs and not virtual knobs on the computer screen. But of course, he says he really likes the software-defined radio movement. I have my kit here, my software-defined radio that the guys from the Soft Rock 40 group sent me, and I'm hoping that this winter I have time to put it together and jump into the world of software defined radios, because there does seem to be a lot that you can do with them. And anytime I come across resistance to new technology, and Bob and I were joking about this. I remember the old QSL cards that were around. I guess even into the 20s and maybe even into the early 30s. Where guys were, complaining about this newfangled CW thing, this new technology that was CW, and you could see a lot of QSL cards had boldly written across the top "Spark Forever." Man, it's just we're a. It's a strange thing in ham radio because we're into new technology. We're technologists. We're innovators and all that. But at the same time, there's a strain of the conservative, the traditional, in all of us. And so I think we all know what those guys were thinking when they wrote "Spark Forever" across the top of their top of those rigs, or about the guys who. The AMers who resisted and in some cases still resist the coming of single sideband. Anyway, thanks for the message, Bob, and we know that you're not among the Luddites. You're with the SDR crowd there. So thanks for that. Finally, we've got a real nice message from Akshay, VA7 Alpha Alpha X-ray. He's 15 years old and surely one of the youngest solder smoke listeners. And I can tell from the contents of his email that Akshay is a true home brewer. He told me that he had built A neophyte receiver, that's the, I guess, the NE602 with an LM386 audio amp. And he said that he got instant gratification from the CW pouring out of it. Yep, I mean, that's it. That's the magic that only comes from a radio that you built yourself. So, actually, really glad that you're listening, and good luck with all the homebrew projects, and keep in touch and let us know what you're building and what you're working on. Guys, that brings us to the end of this year's of this not this year's but of this week's Solder Smoke. We'll have another one. I'm sure we'll have another one out before Christmas. So we'll hold off on the Christmas greetings for now. I know all of you are involved in preparations for the big holiday, and getting many of you out there getting Santa Claus's bags ready for delivery. Wish you good luck with that. We're facing the same situation here. Anyway, that'll wrap up this week's edition of Solder Smoke. Thanks for listening, and 7-3s from Rome.